Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
the most beautiful image I have ever seen. This is a man-made image, and it was a black and white photograph, 3 meters across, or 2.5 meters across, 2 meters tall, taken in the 1860s. And I'll just describe it to you, then I'll get into some stories about why I'm podcasting, why I'm describing the photograph, why I'm, etc., why, and then we'll reveal some sort of intriguing continuations of the story in the photograph. So the photograph's a black and white photograph taken in 63, 64. So this is at the very dawn of photography, especially out here in Australia, where things take a few more years to get out here. And so it's the picture of a wall the size of a building. You can say, what's great about that? Well, at the very bottom, there's sort of grass. It's unkept grass. It's sort of obviously sort of the non-public side of a building. Then it's a stone wall. And for about a meter and a half up, it's whitewashed, brilliant white. In front of it, this is in the mid-foreground, just so, 2 meters in front of the wall, is a white sheet on the ground, and two poles up, and a whale bone. An entire skeleton of a whale constructed. And the whale's about 5 meters long, and you can see all the ribs, the tail, the head, and the poles are going up. And in the back of that is you can see one little ventilation grill to underneath. And then it is a fantastic photograph, and we haven't got to the part of the compositional component. So obviously this is sort of weird, sort of a science photograph all the way back, and obviously it's in a museum. I'll tell you the context of that. I think scratched in that point is the numbers V304, scratched on the negative, so it would have been the white would have been black, and they've scratched the actual negative with the numbers to identify it. And you can see that, but and it's, because they've scratched it through, that's when they're reproducing it, that's the black numbers, and that's carefully done. Then above that is the rest of the museum wall, and the museum wall is not bricks, it's interlocking sandstone, polished sandstone. It's all very flat. It's sort of like a concrete wall of today. It's all very flat. And above that, in the centre, is a window. And the window's got it's basically a smallish window, about a metre across and 2 meters tall. So the top half, it's got the frame around it. Now, this is the interesting thing is that when I recalled it, I recalled it incorrectly. So just a little bit of an aside. I described this photograph on a long series of podcasts. Went home, lost the dictaphone. I have a sort of backup dictaphone, and then I'm describing the game, but in the meantime, I sort of said, oh, look, I'll check this. And my initial memory was just a square hole, black hole. But now when I looked at it, it's actually framed by a white pitch frame. But the interesting thing is that the windows, so the top half of the window is lifted up. It's one of those slide-down windows lifted up. And that's all whited out. So for some reason they have painted the window frames, the windows white. So I would only assume that for it's a laboratory behind there, and for work they don't want a curtain, they don't have a curtain there, and they just want very diffuse white light for, say, precision work. So what often happens is that you think, direct light, but when the sun comes in during the day, it can be hard in the laboratory because it then puts the rest of the laboratory into darkness, so you need diffuse light. Now, this being said, this is not direct sunlight, it's a cloudy day, and it's a very diffuse light. So the ideal photographic region. The top half of the pane is wider, this goes up to the rest. So this is a small, if you can imagine, a small little section dead in the center of the photograph. And in that is a picture of a man with a big white 1860s blousy shirt, a vest, a beard, and these piercing blue eyes which look straight out at you. And it's only at this large scale that this head, you can see this head and these piercing blue eyes and the detection and the... And it's something that you don't get in other photographs. It's this person who has actually leapt through the 1860s and is looking at you and is this most intense view. So everything else is people are framed pictures in their top hats. You know, this is the time of photographing the American Civil War, that type of stuff. And you don't, people have got smiles or, you know, they've got smiles, solemn looks, and they're looking into the camera, but this, they're not, you don't get a glare. In fact, you very rarely get this glare, this intensity. It's sort of like, let's say, I don't know, if you're at a pub and you knock over their whiskey bottles or something, people, you've got this glare, this intent look at you, and so this intent look is coming out at you, and it grabs you. The only other painting that I can, so a picture I can remember having this glare at you is the famous National Geographic picture of a Afghan refugee, and we were getting National Geographic at it, and this picture really struck you, it struck me, but then I realized, so I read another National Geographic article many years later, and this is a highly awarded painting. Now, this picture really did it for me. Now, we're just going to do a little bit, if you can sort of fast forward to the end of the podcast if you're not interested in it, but I'm... there's several layers of what's going on here. I'm at the moment podcasting in the morning, so you can hear the Australian birds, and I'm podcasting while walking. Now, just to give you an idea, it's taken a while to work out how to get the volume and the position. So I have the microphone not fixed to my body, it's actually fixed to my glasses. I've got a pair of reading glasses, and I've got them half on my face because they're just there to hold a microphone. I'm actually looking above them because there's nothing worse, I suppose, than not having good focus and stuff like that. And I'm walking, and why would you combine walking and stuff like that? It's part of cognitive rehab. I've had a heart operation and stuff like that. You've got a brain, vascular brain damage and stuff like that, so you've got to really fight and get back. It's surprising that a lot of people have programmed into them the give up option, because really do it in the in our commercial society. We want to encourage a society on the brink of giving up. They're always on the edge of something. If the customer service isn't right up there, they go to somewhere else. And so we have this give up idea to make our consumers really flexible, such that there's a fluidity in there. There's no point, you know, consumer loyalty would destroy capitalism dead. And part of breaking consumer loyalty is have consumers never satisfied, always critical, moving, so the new person on the block can come out and offer something to be better, and they'll move across. Now this is relevant, that people say when you've got a setback, you will give up. I'm going to have another body, but so they're not, modern capitalism is not necessarily set up, and so I've been given the mission to rebuild and restructure, and what's happening is that bit by bit, some skills are going up, other strategies are coming up. I'm sort of manoeuvring about the place, and so I know ahead of time that I'll be doing a podcast on this area. I better take the information in a large section, so you can see sort of that's building up to come in. Now the other thing about this view of, oh, this is the best it's going to get, and of course a few years ago, or thank goodness a few years ago, when it was all going to be curtains, I was always saying, oh, well, that was the best meal I had. That was the best experience I had. Oh, I'm really grateful for all of this type of stuff. And you sort of realize your limited amount of time and think, you know, it wasn't going to, I was at a point where it wasn't going to get better. And, therefore, sort of in a strange way, it sort of recalibrated yourself. And so, you think that, no, I'm not the typical person on the news or something like that. I'm not this typical punter. I've seen some great things, experienced some great things, sort of seen behind the scenes and things. I don't know. Sort of really specialist moments. And so you sort of are recalibrated. And so when you look here, you say, that's great. And you analyze it and you say, this is going to be the greatest picture I've seen. Now, it's the greatest man-made image, because I've seen other images in science, sort of, it's a real thing, it's real lasers behaving that unusually, there's optical fibers they've built, and they've behaved completely unusually, and I know that I found a section in phase space, which is sort of the knob twiddling and stuff like that. It's going to be really hard to reproduce. And I just invite everyone into the lab and I say, let us enjoy this. And there are people who aren't calibrated to enjoy it. There are some people are. There was a region where I was getting in another time a few years earlier where I had set up a laser perfectly. It was behaving unusually, producing a rainbow spectrum with unusual gas, and I called around the campus of University of Toronto, and I just called some friends in. They came up and I explained what was going on. They said, oh, that's fascinating. And I said, and now here it's working. And then they sort of just enjoyed it. And it's at a point, and both these times, the professors involved said, this is fantastic, this is outside of what we can publish, or what I want to publish, or what I want to do. I had to go, and I knew that already. But I, you know, it's sort of the joy of it here, and here is a sort of a similar example. And so, for me, it's structured to go, I had a sense of it here. Now, let's talk, follow into the line. The whale obviously was a 1960s whale, and it was sort of open season for whales everywhere. We had whaling stations all up the coast of Australia. In fact, the whaling story is a suppressed story. So the early colony lived off whales, and there'd be American villages actually in Australia, whaling villages, when the British came in. And so in South Australia, when people were going to set up Adelaide, which was really a housing estate, British housing estate, set up, and they landed, and there were huts there. There were Aboriginals and American whaling huts. Of course, that's been whitewashed off, or Irish Rebellion early on in the colony. What happened is that there were American whaling ships had come in to the Parramatta River, and there was a big uprising, the Strawberry Hill uprising. And what's happened is that the Australians have whitewashed out our whaling history. Just a small aside for that. We had these unusual whaling stories in Eden. The locals, whalers, struck a bargain with the killer whales or orcas in that area, and they would go out and hunt the whales and bring the whales in for the Australian whalers. They'd kill the whales and give the orcas the tongues. And so there's this many relationships with whales. So, you know, there's that importance of whales, but then the person in the photograph. Now, this is interesting, is that was looking at it, I kept on asking, what is his name? Reading his name again, because I knew to burn him into memory, because it was going, and then straight afterwards, I've forgotten his name. You know, after really trying to learn it, because all the other information coming in was interfering with it. And then my wife sent me an article about it, just the end, and then I got his name. His name is Gerard Kleft. He's a German, an amateur photographer, a non-scientist, and you believe the idea that is that professional scientist, the word scientist didn't begin until 1836 and then established well into the Victorian era. Science is a scientist, as we understand it, is a Victorian fiction, and it is, the scientists are fictionalised with the Victorian, shortcomings. I don't know. I'm really struggling for the words here. This is a Victorian flaws, character flaws. So scientists have these known character flaws, and, you know, they can be tuned up and tweaked into the Big Bang Theory. I think that's the story, Sheldon, that type of stuff. That can be exacerbated in that direction. But at this time, he was an amateur, and there was a museum, and he was into photography. And he drove this massive photography collection and taxidermy, and he got a bit more about taxidermy in the Victorian mind. But the story was he was there, a powerhouse, and everyone was gravitating around him, supporting, and they were just gutting Australian animals and arranging the skeletons, and just filling up this museum super quick. Sydney had been founded in 1788, really didn't get going for 30 years. And so in 30 years it went boom. And of course there was gold rushes and immigration. It suddenly turned off, you know, the end of the Napoleonic Wars, a few revolutions in Europe. This revolution in Europe was just shaking out Germans everywhere, yeah. You know, the Germans went across and took over the British family, the Glorious Revolution and stuff like that. Queen Victoria and the brother, the husband, Albert, and the son, Alfred, Prince Alfred. And he's going to feature in the story in a little while. And you can hear me walking. Now, what I do tend to do is, when podcasting, if I'm podcasting or walking, select quiet shoes, which don't do it, and select footpaths. But what I'm doing now is walking in the Australian bush, a bush path. You can't do that at night. Well, you can do it at night. The problem is to say if you're sick or something like that, the police won't be able to, if you're on a street corner, you can give them, the police can drive up and look after you and stuff like that. It's just, you don't tend to go walking at night because, I don't know, bad things can happen, but by yourself. It's not like I obviously walk in the Australian bush along a paved, you know, in a bitumen old sort of a main road. This is a bush track. You can hear the different birds, and I'm looking across, and there's a valley here, and it's full of white mist, like about 30 metres down. It starts on a blanket of white mist, and you've got the Australian birds all calling up. I thought I'd give you a bit of structure there, as I nearly tripped and fell over a rolling rock there. So Jared Clift is there. He comes along, and he builds this fantastic collection and talks with there were two great British, Wallace. He's communicating with Wallace, giving, you know, this is Greek history, friends. And he's also communicating with Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin's directing him to give photographs, and he's just powering. Charles Darwin hasn't written The Origin of Species yet, but he's producing, and they're assembling gorilla skeletons. And I'll just sort of say how this exhibition, this is exhibition at the Australian Museum. There's several Australian museums, but the Australian Museum in Sydney is a classic Victorian era natural history museum. It's focused on natural history, and we're there. And just to give you a little bit of background, I'm going on with my wife. It's a rainy day, and we've got an appointment to see art exhibition at the Archibald Prize. That's a national portrait painting competition with a grand prize of $100,000. Can you imagine that much money? It's sort of $50,000 in the US, and it's sort of gone bigger than big, all famous names and stories like that. And this is voice described one. We sit down in certain ones, and they describe it, and they have a model that the blind people can feel. And so we had that before, and so we arrived in near a few hours early. It was raining, and if you look at the trajectory, the Museum of Australia's on the Australian Museum's on the way there, and there's a few new exhibitions, and there's one exhibition of the photography archive. I'm going to start doing a loop here. It's going in a quiet place, a beautiful, freezing summer day. Not a cloud in the sky. It's going to warm up a bit. It's just nothing worse than. So last night, I was actually exhausted. Couldn't podcast at night. So this is a bit of a new experiment. But coming back, so we're here, exhibition. And why I'm saying this is that you come in, and the first thing you see is in a glass cabinet, the back of a camera. And you look through that camera if you wanted to. It's only afterwards that I worked out what you could see. And you could look through and see a picture, a upside down photograph, image on the image plane of a Western Plains gorilla skeleton, which had been taken in the 1840s. Yeah, they'd taken out, and that went to Charles Darwin, and that went to the Origins of Species. The anatomical information was being sent out across that direction, and you can imagine although I didn't see it. First, when I worked out what was going on, I looked through and I said, yes, that's explaining it. And so you've got this picture. Now, you quickly read out Jared Clift, K-E-double-F. It's got a double F. It's got Germanic written all over it. And a bit of a description. He's sort of a natural, and you get a little bit of information that he's wrongfully dismissed 10 years later. What? Wrongfully dismissed? See, that alerts you to certain things. And then you see a few more pictures of trying to do these pictures, and they're long exposures, and you can see the long exposures because things are moving in the background. They hold everything still, but when the sheets move in the wind, they blur, but you can actually see that sometimes you see the people holding up the sheet from behind, and you just see the legs behind it. These small little things that you see, so we all know what skeletons are like now, we all know what that is, and it's sort of time to move on. So you're looking at the other aspect. So these photographs have to be taken, and they're put on a white background so they can then pen in and re-black the white background, so it's completely white for your textbook illustration. So that's going across here. Now you're going to hear a little bit of sound as I climb up this little hill in this bush circuit that I'm doing. Okay, so there's that image that we know is gone. I'll sort of try and tell you as it was revealed to me, the mystery of this Gerard Clift, who's going to be a friend of Charles Darwin, producing this thing, fantastic person. But the story goes on, and it shows some more things. They had the skeletons, which they were putting in the museum. Now, of course, they have a way of putting up skeletons, but for its height, kangaroos are very long because of their long tails. So they show the skeleton with the kangaroo tail flipped underneath it. And kangaroos actually do sometimes, or particularly wallabies, have their tail neatly tucked in front of them. And so you immediately see that, and then you see a few Australian animal poses, and they're just wrong. So like the koalas generally aren't sort of like a horse walking up a branch. They hug around the branch, so they're not free standing. So there's a whole lot of things, and they describe that there was a Victorian innovation to actually put a whole sort of series of animals together doing and behaving as they would in the wild. Or there's a stuffed animal. It's a stuffed animal, and they're animated. So idea that came to my mind is basically the Instagram, the meme of these animals. And then you saw the stuffing process, and you saw that a little bit of story of information that a shark was the most impossible thing to stuff. And you go, what? Because shark skin is incredibly thin. What? Yep, it's incredibly thin. You can imagine, oh, that's interesting. And you, just recently imaging, seeing the Indonesian fishing boats just going completely mad, hoovering up all the sharks in the area. So what Indonesia successfully pushed China out of its oceans, part of, diplomacy, sort of fear and terror diplomacy. And of course the fish populations in Indonesia have bounced up. The Chinese aren't doing it, and Indonesia is it's the saying about Indonesia, it's a bright country which has got a great future and always will, in that there's just a level of naive corruption there. So the Australian reporters were looking at the shark population collapse, and they went to an Indonesian fish market. They gave them a day's warning. The Indonesian fish market said, here we are, look, we obey the law, there's no sharks chucks here. And they then said thank you, and then they came back the next day, and they were just wall-to-wall, high-seed sharks everywhere, and people getting with a knife, and they could just get the knife and slice off the shark fin, because shark fins loved in soups, whatever it is, so much so that the vessels go out, and the shark fin costs, $150 a kilogram, sort of, 10 times more. So what they do is they get the shark, catch the shark, cut up the fins and throw it back. But the thing I now notice is that they don't have to work their way through the flesh. It's just really a traveling tube, if that makes sense. So they're going across here. And then you see, another picture of this enormous, monstrous manta ray. These are these flat flying carpets there, sort of a diamond shape with the head at the front, the face pointing down, their bottom feeders, and these are, and with the long tail. Stingrays is one, the small version. These are huge versions. This is the size of a family car, 3 meters from wingtip to wingtip. Their wings are the most beautiful animals. I've seen them in the wild, and they're just, you see it and you go, oh, this is sort of like, you normally see fish, they go across, and the mantle ray is just floating around. And this mantle ray is a massive one. And it's, you sort of see things like, things which start to chill you a bit. There's a large leatherback tortoise, which is sort of like the size of a Galapagos tortoise, but it's a turtle. It's a turtle. And this is huge. And to photograph it, they've actually put it on a cross. And so it's almost, they've crucified it. And the most, chilling thing. And you start to see the Victorian people around. And there's this mantle ray, and you see one. Then you see a picture, which is the most stunning picture, and it's of a Victorian sort of alleyway with the mantle ray upside down, ready, and there's what turns out to be Croft in a white top hat, stuff like that, just casually reading the newspaper next to it. Yeah, that is reading the local newspaper. And you, of course, the reason is that to photograph it, it's a photograph takes a long time, so they have to stay still in a pose that they can hold. And if they're holding a prop, their hands don't move, and they sort of have the image of the photograph ahead of time. The photographer has the photographs in front of time, and they walk in. So if you were just, they walk into the sketch where they're doing, and for some reason he thought this is good, and so you've got this eerie picture of this huge prehistoric beast, and it's, I don't know, 50-60 centimeters thick. It's thicker than a person, but lying down, huge, massive, hundreds of kilograms of fish. And the story is that Prince Alfred, son of Queen Victoria, comes out to Sydney. And we go, and there's a story. We visited this waterworks on the north shore of the Sydney Harbour. And there's a story there of Prince Alfred got shot here. What? Who's Prince Alfred? And this is a bit of a story. So we know a little bit about Prince Alfred already, this amazing, sort of amazing story. And he was really the first royal, like Australia switched on, and this is the first royal visit, and a lot of people would be in Australia and talk about royalty, talk about the homeland, of course nothing would be there, and once there was a royalty there, this went over the top. It was the biggest thing ever to happen in Australia. And he visited the newly constructed Australian Museum, and Gerard Clift had an hour with the Prince because of the Victorian science interest, explaining the massive collection. And I sort of it went over, great thing. Then this mantle ray came in and he said, we have to name it. We're going to name it after the prince. And of course, I have now a way point of sending the prince a photograph and saying, can we name it after you? Now, have I been guilty of doing something similar things to that? Is just trying to work out, and these things always backfire. Not that your mad mind thinks along these directions, and there is this code way of doing it where you think of the idea, you put it forward, and then you stand completely back. Because he didn't do this. And they named this huge mantle ray mantle ray of Frio and stuff like that. So the combination of him getting too big for his boots and the conservators of the museum. So I'm a museum at Victorian history. Oh, and now you're saying that we're descended. We are actually part of this museum. We're descended from apes. So your science has gone outside our sensibilities. And we're a Christian. They're all Christian aboard. And it's not until you read from this era, the philosophers, and you only read it because it's foundational information. That is, people believe what they are saying. They don't look at the foundation. A lot of their foundation beliefs are structured in Victorian fictions. That is, from the era, the 18, whatever it is, they have fictions, and no one, and they've built forward, and no one has gone back to recorrect it, to readjust. So, indeed, scientists aren't these flawed individuals. They have got these other attributes, and all that type of stuff. But these people are profoundly Christian, and this is my own interpretation putting in, they create a chaos bubble around a person that they want to shove out, they start accusing him of stealing gold from the museum. Now, you've got to understand at this stage that museums and institutions used to accumulate precious metals and gold for various reasons. So there's certain cases where you're cleaning up in various labs and you uncover, I kid you not, bullion and stuff like this. Historically, for some reason they did it. And then there was things of fabricating fraud. And this bubble of confusion and chaos grew around this person. And they broke him. And this is the next story, is that he was so broken that they had to take him, physically a broken man, Gerard Clift, out of the museum on a chair. Yeah. So this is sort of almost a medieval story. They took him out of a chair. He's a broken man. He couldn't walk anymore. He went out and he died a few years later. A broken, destroyed man, destroyed by the Christian conservatism of it. And these people obviously to make up a lie about a person is wrong, but there's this sort of madness which goes around people where people say, you know, chaos bubble, and they create a chaos bubble around the person. I only know this because I've seen this firsthand a couple of times happening. This is where the people become, they, hands off the tiller, processing, they just make up lies, they create this, everything is chaotic. And this person, if they respond, they say, well, you are just creating chaos. So you want to create more chaos, you want to respond, and of course, they are crucified. That is, crucifixion is having a leader, you put them out there, and you have it a person obviously suffering, obviously in need of support, but the society around it cannot provide support. And this is sort of like a practical reprogram, you know, how to quickly reprogram someone not to support someone. You crucify them and you make sure that the people can't offer support to them. It's very antagonizing to the person, but it restructures, resets your organization to crucify something. So you've got this whole series of processes happening here. So he's taken out of here to die. So this, if you can imagine, you know, this photograph saying, oh, this person has reached out of the 1860s and somehow grabbed me and pulled me into the 1860s and stuff like that. And I'm with him as he does these various things, and then chaos erupts around him, and he gets crushed into the individual, not put on a crucifix, but put on a chair and taken out. And then just, you can imagine, they wouldn't carry him with the chair very far. They'd carry him over there, and a horse and cart would take him out, and he would die. And so really, in terms of he lives on through this painting, scientifically, you know, this picture, scientifically. And he's unaware of all this happening on. And the trick at the end of this is that the chair, that's a very interesting chair, let's put that in a museum. And so you've got all these blah, 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 all these animals and stuff like that, and then you start to get these odd things in the museum, like a chair. There's a koala, a various range of hopping marsupials, there's a gorilla, there's obviously from around the world, there's all these exotic fish, blah, 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 and a chair. And the chair is in the museum as an artifact, and indeed it's the most insane artifact. It's sort of like the true cross, the true cross of scientific persecution. So it's there, and I could go on about it. The interesting thing is the Natural History Museum starts to have things which are imposed by, it's a natural history museum. It's a museum of natural history as imagined coming forward. So it's no longer a museum. I suppose it is a museum of natural history, but it's a museum of museums, if that makes sense. And you start to get these things in it, like the chair appearing. And that makes sense because it is a museum of museums, and it has another thing of has a major sponsor of a bank, so it has the first New South Wales banknote in it, and that's in there. And why is it there? Oh, the bank's sponsor. This is the importance, and it's sort of just it's expanded, it's brief just enough to capture important things for it to survive, and it voluntarily tells the story of itself. And so that, my friend, is the story. It's a bit of my story recovering, a bit of my story trying to put things together, and it's a bit of your story, I hope, listening to these podcasts, which I'm trying to gradually improve as we go along. Thanks for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.